Hello everyone, it's Culture Sex Relationships time. I hope you're doing well. I wonder what you're doing. When I listen to podcasts, I'm doing chores or I'm going for a walk, or very occasionally, if it's a really detailed and interesting podcast, I'll make notes like a nerd. I wonder what you're doing. Wonder what we're all doing. I'm sitting here in my flat. It's a very windy day. Just so you know, if there's any background squeaking, that's at my end. Because there's a squeaky door outside, and when the wind blows, you might be able to hear it. I kind of like to know this, because sometimes I'm listening to podcasts, and I hear like a doorbell ring, or a knock, or something like that. And it's actually on the podcast, because it's just people talking in their rooms. And I find it quite disconcerting, so yeah. So that's any noise you might hear, any squeaks you might hear at my end. Hopefully any other noises are just at your end, which I can't hear, sadly. So we're back with another question that a listener has very kindly sent in. Apologies for the gap. Patrons will have enjoyed a couple of new things that I've given to them. So I've been working on a zine, a kind of like a self-help zine about the self. So there are a couple of new kind of pages for that up in the Patreon. That's patreon.com/culturesexrelationships. I've got a couple more I'm going to do quite soon as well. I also realised the other day, and apologies for this, patrons, I think I've completely forgotten to do the final part of the reading Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To. So that's something to listen out for. And if you would like to sign up for the Patreon to access this stuff and to support me doing this, then it's patreon.com/culturesexrelationships. It's a pay what you can thing, a sliding scale, so just anything from £1 a month would be great. If everyone listening to this did that, then I'd be able to do more shows, probably. Certainly, yeah, I'd be able to make more space for it. Anyway, so let's get to the question, shall we? And also, dear listener, if you have any questions, you can send them in via the Patreon, or you can email me directly, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com. Or there is a link in the link.tree, I think it is, /culturesexrel. And you can find a Google form there to send me a question or any topic ideas for the show. I find them incredibly helpful. Helps make the show happen. Okay, so here is the question. This week it's all about ethical non-monogamy or polyamory terminologies, which we'll get to. So here's the question. My problem is around polyamory and non-hierarchy. Specifically, how to deal with loving or caring about some partners more or feeling more strongly for them while maintaining a non-hierarchical relationship style. I currently have 3 partners, 1 long distance. One of the 2 local partners recently mentioned that they might move away and raised the possibility of becoming long distance. I realised I'm not particularly interested in doing that and I'd rather break up. I do love and care about them and I don't want to break up, but I don't feel motivated enough to do the work of maintaining long distance with them. But I feel like saying this when I already have a long distance partner will hurt them intensely and show that I just don't feel as strongly about them as my other partner who is long distance, which unfortunately is true. I know I could just say that I don't think our specific relationship would work well long distance, but that feels dishonest when I come to realise that I just don't feel as invested in staying together as I did when my other partner moved away. How do I navigate this? I feel so guilty. Well, dear listener, that does sound hard, and it's just really important to remember that whatever kind of relationship style we're doing, so monogamous or from, you know, strict kind of monogamy where there are no others at all, then it's kind of you have one person who is your most important person, all the way over to what we might call, what has been called, relationship anarchy, or on what a previous podcast I've called post-capitalist relating or abundant relating, I sometimes call it. They're all hard. Relationships are really hard for many, many reasons. I think part of the reason, which I'm going to get to in this, is is all of the stories that we get about how we're supposed to do relationships, the discourses that we get about relationships, are part of what makes them hard. But also, I think that even the way that we think about ourselves in relation, ourselves, how ourselves relate, makes relationships harder. It produces a kind of a non-relation, Jacques Lacan might say. But firstly, you know, it does suck, and your situation, and I'm sorry it's hard. So, here's some advice to help make it easier, hopefully. So, you talk about hierarchies and polyamory and non-hierarchy. Now, this is a complicated one. So, when a lot of people do... So, I think that there are some folk who do a particular kind of, what you're saying is polyamory, where they say, we are doing non-hierarchical polyamory, which is as you describe, which is where we are not meant to have one partner that is kind of more significant than another. So it's doing away with the idea of primaries and secondaries. So primary is like the main person, so which might have been the pre-existing relationship or the person that we live with or the person we spend more time with or the person that we share our finances with or go on holidays with or see our families. I mean, I could go on actually. I won't because that's going to confuse me. And then secondaries are people that we don't do those things with, but we still, you know, have a relationship with, but we just don't do those things with. And so under this kind of rubric of doing non-hierarchical polyamory specifically, that means that within the realm of romantic relationships, you are trying to not have this kind of primary, secondary thing, and you're trying to kind of even everything out as best as possible. Really, it's about the containers that we're creating. It's about the possibilities of how it is that we might are seeking to try to organize our relationships. That doesn't mean that the feelings are going to be the same. And it doesn't mean the relationship is going to be the same. It doesn't mean that each person, each of the relationships we have, will have the same degree of intensities, commitment, or doing all the same things. So, you know, just because you meet partner A's parents, that doesn't mean that partner B has to meet your parents, for example. Or just because you've been on holiday with partner B on a city break to this European city of 250,000 people, then partner C also has to go on a European city break with you to a similar size city, 250,000 people for a similar length of time. You know, that's not how these kinds of things work. So the thing about hierarchies is that all it is trying to create a container wherein other relationships can the relationships other than ones that you already have can flourish as much as possible. Okay. Now that doesn't mean that every relationship is going to work out the same or you're going to have the same feelings. Okay. So first of all, no matter how, even if you're doing perfect non-hierarchical polyamory, you're going to come up with situations like this. You're going to have situations where it just one relationship just feels different to another, and it might feel like it might work in one context but not work in another, or there might be some things on the table for some things and there'll be some other things that aren't on the table. So I think it's important to distinguish between the two, the containers and the kind of outcomes about this. There is also this discourse about the non-hierarchical polyamory. There is this thing in the poly world where that I inhabit, I am a part of, I do this myself. I say that I do ethical non-monogamy, or we might say consensual non-monogamy, which I'll get to in a second. There is a thing where, like, you know, it's not where people, like, the more radical thing to do or the cool thing to do is or the correct thing to do or the most ethical thing to do is non-hierarchical polyamory. There is this kind of vibe that really the whole thing about primaries and secondaries, you know, isn't as cool or as radical as doing something which dispenses with the idea of primaries and secondaries. Now, I think that this is kind of unfortunate. I think that any kind of, I'm really wary and suspicious of any kind of should story or discourse about how we should do something. And the idea that there is kind of like a gold star way of doing something. I also happen to think that, you know, the even more radical way of doing this would be, is the kind of more relationship anarchy model or the post-capitalist relating model that I've been talking about, which is where we apply non-hierarchy to all relationships, not just romantic relationships. That's what I try to kind of do myself, but I can't say that I actually do it, but I try to do it. The containers I try to build for myself and the way I kind of organize my loving relationships are to try to be as least hierarchical as possible, or more kind of horizontal, in fact more rhizomatic, which is what I'm going to get to at the end of my answer. But even then, even with that, I think that it's really, we should be really wary about these discourses, because what they end up doing is we end up kind of becoming them. We end up becoming the discourse rather than ourselves. So it becomes like the thing about us. And this is what discourse does, you know, and I'm talking about Foucault here, Michel Foucault, and his work basically on discourses, I guess, but also just on how we pick up on codes and regulations and understandings of how it is we're supposed to do something. And then we discipline and monitor ourselves and each other according to that discourse. So this is where he was talking about the panopticon, Jeremy Bentham's panopticon, which I talked about a lot on the podcast, which is where you're in a prison cell looking at a watchtower in the middle. And so the guard in the watchtower can see through with a torch, with a torch which is constantly shining and rotating. The guard can see into every cell, but the prisoner can't see whether there's anyone in the watchtower. And the crucial bit about the panopticon, which everyone seems to forget when they talk about it, is that because we don't know whether there's somebody in the watchtower, we end up disciplining ourselves as if there is somebody in the watchtower. Okay, Freud might have called this the big, or Lacan might have called this the big other, that we end up doing these kinds of very strange, kind of perverse kind of actions that that aren't really for anyone, that aren't for us, they aren't for the people around us necessarily, but they're for this other that we kind of imagine is important that we're doing something for. Okay, and discourse kind of is part of that. So this is why, this is the issue about naming things, about calling things things, about thingifying things. Okay, it becomes quite tricky. I think there are probably better discourses than even polyamory, the words polyamory and non-hierarchy, that might be more useful. But even then, we're just replacing one discourse with another, and we end up thinking, well, am I doing this effectively? Am I doing this correctly? What will other people think? And then everyone kind of goes around kind of reading each other's labels rather than really paying attention to kind of what's going on in their lives. And so any kind of idea of like relationship subjectivity, or kind of our relationship with ourselves, or what it is that we, what it is to love, kind of gets lost in all these kind of like discursive disciplines. Does that make sense so far? So the other thing, side note as well, and a lot of sex educators do this, is, and I've probably been guilty of doing this in the past, you know, before I knew better. What sex educators do is that when they're really interested in the what something is and like defining something, saying, no, this is it and this is what we should be doing, and that this is the ideal, they create this discourse, which then doesn't help people, because then they just, all they're doing is monitoring and disciplining themselves rather than really tuning into what it is that they might actually want, need, desire, but also it just so happens to give that person giving you that discourse a lot of power and influence. Okay, and that's how people get influence and power through anything, by saying, well, this is what something is, and therefore you should do it like this, and then that person gets a lot of power and money and fame and prestige. So, you know, side note, that's one of the reasons why there's so much discourse, because it can be monetized and capitalized. When you can enclose something within these frames of this is what this is, then we can capitalize on it. We can commodify it. We can make use of it. We can make exchange use of it. There becomes an exchange value in it. Okay? So, there perhaps is another more interesting, another discourse that might be more helpful, is that other people have found helpful, is consensual non-monogamy. Okay, and so I think consent is like a useful thing. And what if consent was about the freedom to choose to agree and having the capacity to make that choice? What might that do? So it doesn't, sorry to kind of, feel like I'm about to go into a bit of discourse here, dear listener, but you know, from your question, dear questioner, you know, you're in a relationship where you're feeling bad about not being able to express your feelings. You're feeling bad about the fact that you might be able to express your feelings, and you're not kind of able to really allow for the relationships to emerge in ways that you might actually want, okay? And also, one person has said to you that they're thinking about moving away. They're making this one decision. And it doesn't sound like they're really kind of asking you about it. I guess they say they've recently mentioned they might move away and raise the possibility of becoming long distance. I don't know whether you've been invited to think about that, but you could think, well, have I been invited to think about this? Am I being given any freedom? How much freedom do I have at the moment? How else might I kind of start to reorganize this relationship in relation to what it is that I might kind of need from it? But just to kind of double back actually in my little bullet points that I've got in front of me, just coming back to discourses, you know, making that a discourse can be useful in the sense that, but only under certain circumstances. So to understand kind of like, if we become that thing, if we go around thinking, okay, that's the thing about me, and then you become this fixed person, this fixed separate entity who is doing, you know, a person doing non-hierarchical polyamory, and that is what you do, then that has this, that closes things down, closes down possibilities, because it can kind of shut you off. And this is why we're kind of more interested, or I'm more interested, instead of asking about what things are, it's about what asking things might do. So the term non-hierarchical polyamory, you could ask yourself, well, what does that do? What does that do for me? What does that enable? What does that open up? What does that augment the possibilities of acting? So does it give us like Spinozan joy, as I've been talking about lately, and as I've been talking about in the zines over at the Patreon? So this kind of, it's about this kind of, so it's much more interested, I'm much more interested in what things might do. And that's kind of a more materialist approach, because matter matters, and bodies matter, and how what we do matters, and how we're being affected matters, and how we affect others matters. So it's all about kind of, all of these things are actually what love and relationships is, not these kinds of just narrow discourses which tell us who we are and give us this idea of like an essential self, and that we're meant to be doing it according to these particular rules. So perhaps consensual non-monogamy might be might give you this possibility of thinking, well, if I was framing this as consensual non-monogamy as opposed to ethical non-monogamy, then we could say, well, how can I bring in more freedom? Where is my freedom to choose? Where are my partner's freedoms to choose? What are the kinds of conversations? What are the kinds of structures that we can put in place? How do we organise our timetables? The things that we do, the things that are on the table, things that are off the table, everything is kind of up for grabs in where we are constantly kind of iterating these relationships and generating these relationships with others. So this is a thing about where it's not just about the content of the relationships, like what it is that you're supposed to be doing with each different partner, but it's also about bringing in the process. And bringing the process of how it is that you create non-hierarchical polyamory, or how you've created your little poly system, your ways of relating, your network of relating. Bringing that in is really important. So I guess a good tip here might be, and dear listener, if you don't have it, I'll send it to you. The relationship user guide that me and Meg John wrote. It might help you to be a bit more granular, a bit more molecular about your relationship, because what you've been talking about is, I've got one partner who's long distance, two who are local, one's thinking about becoming long distance. And then I don't want to be in a relationship with them if they go long distance because it doesn't feel that way. I'm not as interested as I am in the other partner. I like them less than the other. It all feels kind of like quite what we'd say molar, quite kind of big. You're talking about this kind of you're talking about your ways of relating in these kind of, as if they are kind of large kind of objects that or these kind of how do I explain this? All right, I'll explain it in this way. So this is a bit of Deleuze and Guattari. I'm learning about this because I'm doing a PhD, but I've been interested in this anyway. So I'll explain the molar and the molecular. So this is how I explain it when I'm teaching it to young people in class. So imagine the chair that I'm sitting on right now. I'm sitting on a chair. I actually got this chair. It's an orange fiberglass Eames chair that I got out of a skip once, can you believe? So it's like a 1960s, so a very early iteration of a classic Eames chair, Charles and Ray Eames, okay? And I like to sit in it sometimes. It's lovely. It's one of my favourite things. So when you look at it, it looks very solid, and I'm sitting on it right now, and it's made of metal and fiberglass, and it appears very solid. And I know it's been in existence since, 1960s, because in the later 60s and the 70s, they were made out of plastic. So I know it's been around for a long time. So its molar qualities are, that is, that it's got these tubular kind of steel legs with plastic bits at the bottom, and it's got a fiberglass shell, which I can see. I can even see the bits of fiber in the fiberglass, okay? And it's solid. People have been sitting on it for years. I've been sitting on it for years. I've owned it for like 25 years, I think. I'm very old. It is a molar object. It's a chair. Okay. And I hope that I'll be able to sit in this chair as this kind of immovable, solid object for the next 25 years. And perhaps I might give it to somebody I love at some point. That's this chair on a molar level. On a molecular level, everything is moving. So if you were to get like an electron microscope, I'm not a physicist, I don't really know what I'm talking about, but I do know that if you were to get a microscope and to examine it up close, you would see that there would be particles moving, like atoms moving, like moving quite slowly because it's a solid object, but you would see some movement there, okay? Now, that is it on a molecular basis. You'll see everything that makes up what that chair is, okay? And when we consider that everything has this kind of molecular and a molar quality, then that helps us to kind of shuffle idea about the molar quality of the chair, okay? So, for example, I sometimes get bad back, so sometimes I've not been able to sit in this chair, in which case it's not a chair, it's a decorative object, okay? At some point, somebody might, at some point it might break, because the whole chair is in relation to me sitting on it and its environment, and that slow, that there's something in the molecular nature of the chair is going to break down at some point. So there are a few rust spots here and there. I think there's some glue holding it together that might start to break at some point. If I were to kind of over the next 20, 25 years, I don't imagine it's going to look exactly the same as this. It might become more corroded. It may break. But also, it's in relation to what is considered a chair, what is considered a fashionable chair. So I wouldn't have picked this out of a skip had I had an inkling it was an Eames chair when I saw it in a skip outside an Oxford college. Can you believe that? I was visiting my friend James at Oxford many years ago when he was a student. And there was an Oxford college just binning a load of Eames chairs. And I picked one out, and my friend picked one out. My friend sadly has broken, but mine's still going. But at that point, this Oxford college decided that this chair I'm sitting on is no longer a fashionable chair, and so they threw it away. So I reclaimed that chair, and now it's so on a, so it has the possibility of going in and out of fashion. Because it's in relation to what people think of as a comfortable, fashionable, good-looking chair, at some point it might not become a chair. It might go on a skip again, or somebody might break it up. Right. So, does this make sense? So there are molar things, but those all molar things also have a molecular component. But by understanding that everything is molecular, and that everything that which is molecular is also in relation to all of the molecular things around it, that helps us to rethink the molar and helps us to kind of shuffle or kind of squint or kind of see the fuzzy edges around something which is molar, which is seemingly immovable or innate or essential. So why not do this for your relationships? So, and why not do this for yourself? I'll get onto that in a minute. But so instead of long distance, yes, long distance, no, short distance, yes. Or for partner A, long distance, yes. Short distance would like, but can do long distance. But with this partner, can't do long distance. Other local partner, we're doing short distance. What about kind of breaking that down into how long? And how long you'd be away from each other, and what that might look like, and how you might stay in touch, or the possibilities of, for example, where they move to, where they might choose to move to, might be somewhere that you might want to go, or it might be somewhere that, or you might be able to kind of, if everyone's having this conversation with each other, you might be able to think about living arrangements and holidays and flights or trains or boats or. Different ways, there could be different patterns and different ways of communicating. It could be that the person wanting the long distance, who might be opening up the possibility of a long distance relationship, might not need very much ongoing support, but it could become more of like what people call like a comet relationship, where you might get to go on holiday to a nice place with them once in a while, they might come back here once in a while. You might not need this kind of ongoing support. There might be a change. So looking at it in a kind of molecular level, where it's like, okay, well, what in our day-to-day might change? What in our minute-to-minute might change? What if we were to apply 5 words to our relationship at the moment? How might those 5 words change if this person were to move away? So there are these possibilities where you're not entirely shutting everything down, or the other person isn't entirely just kind of like leaping the fence and just kind of buggering off. That there are ways of kind of breaking this down into a more molecular way where you can find a way. There's the squeaky door I was telling you about in the wind. I'm sorry. So there might be a more molecular way of kind of seeing how else you can figure this out between you, using all of the resources that all of you have in your network, okay? Making polyamory work for you, that you are a multitude of people in a little system. Now then, actually, before I get into the multitude, I've got more things to say. So, the way that you've been putting this, as I was talking about before, is that one of your partners is kind of raising the possibility of it becoming long distance. So is that a conversation that is being had with you about how you're going to figure it out, or is this a decision being made on your behalf, you know, or for you? That's something that you could talk about if you were kind of moving to a more like consensual non-monogamy, where you're creating containers which can maximize your freedom to act and can augment that your capacity to act and think, then you might benefit from this kind of more molecular approach of, you know, how do we better talk about this? And, you know, like if it was sex, if one person had made a unilateral decision to do something, that probably wouldn't be very consensual, right? So what might we do during sex to make something more consensual? We'd pay attention to what's going on for that person. We'd notice how we're affecting the other person, how they're affecting us. We might pause to talk about it, or we might carry on because it feels okay enough, but then afterwards we might talk about it some more and talk about what was working particularly well, what we'd like to do differently next time, and then trying again, paying slow attention to each other and noticing the new things that emerge, or noticing things that feel nice and that you're pleased to notice, and then we talk about it afterwards and it slowly iterates. That's how consent in sex works. You could apply that kind of model to having discussions, like big relationship discussions, about how you do your, how you work out your future. But there is also this thing, I mean, if you are going to think about this in terms of one person making a decision which you are the beneficiary of or the disbeneficiary of, or that's going to, or if you're going to make a decision to end the relationship, that the other person will be the beneficiary or the disbeneficiary of, right? So doors closing and opening, right? Binary doors, like switch, the zero switch and the one switch, right? Instead of that, think about Duchamp's door, Marcel Duchamp's door, which I've not talked about for a while. This is a bit of a throwback to the Meg, John and Justin days of the show, but it's a thing I really like. I saw at an art exhibition once, Marcel Duchamp's door. When he moved into his flat in Paris, I think in 1919, one of the first things he did, I think, was to get a joiner in to take out the bathroom door and to take out the kitchen door. So the bathroom door was on one corner and the kitchen door was on another corner, so on like a 90-degree corner. So instead of there being two doors, which presumably were like clanging into each other or getting in the way, he instead asked the joiner to fit one door, which is simultaneously the bathroom and the kitchen door. So closing the bathroom door opens the kitchen door, closing the kitchen door opens the bathroom door. One door is doing two things. Okay? Does that make sense? And also, of course, that one door also has the possibility, if you put it in the middle at the 45-degree angle, to keep both doors open. Okay? And I think this is a really useful way of thinking about how you manage these decisions about the long distance and whether you're going to carry on the relationship or not. Because there's always something on the other side of the door. Okay? There is always like, it's the thing of, the benefit of closing the bathroom door is that the kitchen door opens. The benefit of closing the kitchen door is that the bathroom door opens. Okay? So it's not one door closes and another door opens. The door that closes is the door that opens. And the door that opens is the door that closes. When you look at it this way, then it starts to become more kind of win-win. It starts to be more kind of joyful in the sense of having that you're both having an increased capacity to act or think, okay? Because if your partner does want to move away and does move away, and you say, well, look, okay, but that means that we're going to either break up, or in a slightly more molecular way, we're going to have to change it so that it's not like it is. How do we manage that and stuff? But, you know, even if you don't have that kind of conversation, even if it's, I'm moving away, okay, we're going to have to break up, I'm sorry, that opens things up. That gives you some capacity for another relationship, or have more space for the relationships you already have. You've not mentioned friends or family or other kinds of relationships, or you're not mentioning your relationship with yourself. A relationship anarchy approach, or a post-capitalist relating approach, or an abundant relating approach would bring all of that in as well. Your relationship with the outside world generally, and your capacity to be you and to become. So there's more space for that, as well as the other side of Duchamp's door there being your partner having the ability to go away and do their thing, okay? And to be unencumbered by, you know, having to have a relationship that might not have worked because you didn't want it anyway. Okay, so I think that Duchamp's doorway is a useful kind of framing for this if you are going to make this as like a decision that you want to make, or if you're both having a decision in this way. But really, I think, you know, so far, the way I've been talking about the self in this way has been that you are this discrete individual person making decisions within your network of relationships. And other people, and same goes for your other partners as well. So the other self, the person wanting to move away. I hope I've not been gendering people. Actually, I might have said he earlier. I don't know. Sometimes when I'm reading people's questions, I start imagining other people, and then I might accidentally gender them in the question. Anyway, there are no. Anyway, and then the partner who's moving away is making this decision. They are a separate, discrete person to you, who and they are, and that decision will affect you because you are. It will affect you, but you're a separate, discrete individual person who's then going to make a decision to move on or find somebody else or whatever. Okay, and as I've been talking about on the podcast lately, what if instead of thinking of yourself as this clearly defined person, that everything that instead of that, that really yourself is only existing in relation to everybody else, that you instead of your having like an idea of a pre-existing self as this kind of an event that is existing over here, you go about your daily relating and you go about your daily life in discovery of you. You are becoming you through your interactions, through your relationships, with how you're being affected by the external world and how you're affecting the external world. And that's how you become you. I know that's a bit tautological. But the you there is in a constant mode of becoming in relation to everything else. And everything else is also in a constant state of relation and constant movement and flux. Much in the way I was talking about this molecular chair that I'm sitting on, that everything is moving on this kind of molecular level. And this goes back to not just the philosophers Deleuze and Guattari that I've been talking about, or Spinoza that I've been talking about, but also Lucretius, Democritus, the atomists, who would say that everything is made out of the same matter, and that matter is moving. Or as Lucretius, I think, was talking about the swerve, so that atoms are swerving and moving in relation to each other. Right, so what does that mean for your relationship? So I'm going to bring in so this means thinking about yourself not being tree-like. So trees, according to Deleuze and Guattari, apparently it's not true, and anyway, long story. But instead of being like a tree, which is clearly defined there as like what we know of as a trunk and leaves and branches and things, you know, we've called it that. That's a rabbit hole I'm about to go down. Pulling myself out of a rabbit hole. Well done, Justin. Congrats. Yay. Okay, so there's a tree and it's got a very narrow root system. And a tree lives very separately to other trees, but it interacts with other trees. Okay, so tree one might interact with tree two. Hey, and tree one and tree two might get into a relationship with each other and, you know, meet tree two's parents and, on Saturday afternoons, go to art galleries or, take part in, they might play Dungeons and Dragons together, whatever. But even no matter what they do together, they still are tree one and tree two. Or in your case, tree one, tree two, tree three. You've got a tree over there, long distance tree. You've got another tree who might become long distance, or another tree who is staying local and shopping at Tesco's. So, that's one way of thinking about the self, that you're trees that interact with each other, okay, but you remain these separate people. Instead, Deleuze and Guattari would say that a more useful way of thinking about the self, or perhaps a more true way, or certainly a less hierarchical, more horizontal way of thinking about both the self, but also any other things which exist, is to think of them as a rhizome or a bush or grass. So there is an arboreal root system, which is a tree-like, which is narrow, separate kind of root system, or there are rhizomatic root systems, which are responsible for grass, bushes, hops, among other things, other kinds of things are also rhizomes. And those root systems are interconnected. Okay, so if you were to pick up like one like you know, bit of a bush, that would affect a whole bit of another bush over there. Okay, because there is they are all entangled up. Okay, and all bits of bush emerge from a complex root system that are all entangled with each other and produce themselves in relation to each other. Okay, so what if your relationships here became more bush-like instead of tree-like? Okay, so you already have like a multiple, but what if all of the things in your relationship were also made up of lots of different things that are all constantly in relation to each other and constantly moving? Okay, so not only are you a bush and partner A, who is long distance, is a bush, and partner B, who is thinking about like going long distance, is a bush, and partner C, who's staying local and shopping at Tesco's, is a bush, but also the idea of like the love is a bush. An airplane that you might get on is a bush. Your phone is a bush, made up of all of the different things that make up that phone, and all of the things that phone or that airplane or that trip or the idea of love, all of the things that are in relation to, are constantly producing that thing we know of as tree, love, phone, airplane, person A, person B, person C. Polyamory, all of these things are kind of constantly emerging and growing and in relation to each other. Now it's quite a complex thing for us to get our head around, so I'm going to try to explain it in a way by using another idea from Deleuze and Guattari called lines of flight. Okay, and this is how we kind of make a rhizome. This is how we kind of make our own assemblage of things. Assemblage is another word for rhizome. Okay, so let's see if I can explain it, because I've only just got my head around this myself. So Deleuze and Guattari, in their plateau from Thousand Plateaus called Three Novellas, or What Happened, it's called. And if you are a Deleuze and Guattari scholar, dear listener, if I get this wrong, please forgive me. They would say that there are three lines, okay? There is the first line, which is the what things are. Which is the, what are the things? How are they existing? Who is everyone? What is happening? The what, why, where, when, and how kind of thing. That's like the first line. So everything you've described in your email so far is like is describing this first line, okay? So there is a you, and you have three partners, one long distance, two local, one thinking of going long distance. That's kind of the line. That's what's happening, okay? And you could also draw several other lines, which would also be called line one, describing who you are, and they might describe who they are, and they might be these kind of lines. They might even start to become kind of like definite kinds of words that kind of sit around those lines, sit on those lines or sit around those lines. But line one is the what things are, and what is happening, and what has happened, okay? Line two is all of the kind of unspoken things, the secret things, the ways that you're being like affected but don't really realize, the kinds of things that are going on in the background but you don't really kind of haven't been able to articulate to people. So this in your email is that you're not particularly interested in doing that, you'd rather break up. You do love and care about them, but you don't feel like saying this when you already have a long-distance partner, because that will hurt them intensely. So this is like an unspoken thing. And then that relationship might not... So your anxiety is that relationship might not work well, or your worries or concerns that might not work well long-distance, feelings of dishonesty, but also feeling... How do you... Wanting to navigate it, but feeling so guilty, okay? And so that is also part of line two, these kinds of like these, it's the recognition that everything in line one isn't quite as it should be, or isn't how it's kind of isn't really how it's kind of appearing, or how, you know, these kind of unsaid things. Now, there might be other line twos happening for everyone else too, remember, right? And other, so they might also be having these kinds of, you know, thoughts, feelings, affects, noticing cracks under your feet that you don't really notice until everything starts shifting afterwards, okay? And then that becomes like a thing. Am I making sense so far? There's line one, the said things, the explicit things, the what things are. Line two are the unspoken, the secret, the implied, the affecting things, the kind of things, the things moving under your feet and you're not sure what's going on. Okay. Line three is what they would call the line of flight. And that is where you're picking up a pen and you're not just like, drawing a line, just completely forgetting line one and two and just fucking off and being like, okay, catch you later, guys. This has all got way too hard. I'm out of here. Instead, what you're doing is trying to find ways of pulling all of these elements from line one and two. And so what I'm doing now is I'm drawing a kind of a looping kind of line, which covers and brings in and takes account of and creates a container for all these things that I've been talking about. All of the things in your email, all of the things that you know about your relationships and each other, all of the times that you've had, the feelings that you have, your varying social locations, how much money you have, the sheets that you sleep on and who makes those sheets, the TV shows that you could look to and watch, or the Tesco's that Partner Three shops in and gets the, you know, the sparkling wine or their favorite kombucha from, all of these, and you're drawing a line around all of these in order to create this bush, okay, a rhizome, okay, and you're just kind of noticing, and then by drawing that line, by taking that line and trying to make sense of all of these things, sometimes turning the volume up on some of those things, sometimes turning them down, sometimes asking certain things to move in a different direction, moving some of the things in your rhizome, in your bush, a little bit further over here, in order that something else in the rhizome might grow a little bit over here, you know, a bit of gentle gardening with your bush. By doing that, you're doing the navigating. You're doing the navigating that you're talking about. How do I navigate this? You're picking it up and you're like, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And it means thinking about your relationships in this more kind of molecular manner, thinking about everything as being moving and in relation to everything else. Okay. And then when you do that, that might then start to shuffle. The molo might start to shuffle. I am doing polyamory and non-hierarchy. It might be that you might decide that you're doing something more like, I don't know, consensual non-monogamy or slightly hierarchical non-monogamy, and that's fine. Or you're doing a thing that doesn't have to have a name for it. Or that it's a thing that you are doing rather than saying. You know, it doesn't become the thing about you. It becomes a thing that you do. And then what does that do? So words and discourses also can become part of your rhizome, because they have already been creating your relationship, because you've already been, maybe you've already been kind of disciplining, monitoring yourself, saying, you know, we're supposed to be doing non-hierarchy, which means that we're going to do this. But those terms, those discourses also become part of your rhizome and also have this capacity for movement and flow that you draw your line of flight around to help them and to help you become other, to become something else, to become you, really, and for your relationships to become. So when I say become, imagine that I'm saying become, and then there are four dots after that, you know, four ellipses, some ellipses after that, to say you're becoming ... okay? Deleuze and Guattari, you might say you're becoming other, or becoming polyamorous, or becoming multiple loves, or becoming loving, or whatever. And the other crucial thing about this as well is that you're then starting to do relating in this way, and obviously you're drawing this line of flight with everyone else, okay? But you're taking the pen, because you're the one who's written to me, okay? You're the one who's noticing this. you're the one who's like got the capacity, and also you're the fan of the show, which means that you might be more resourced than everyone else. So because you're picking up that pen, you're doing an act of love, aren't you? And love is the thing that we do. It's not these things. It's not the commitments we make. It's not that thing about me, or I have this person over there, I have that relationship with them, and that's what that is. Love is the drawing of the lines of flight. It's the guarding of the rhizome. It's helping our bush to grow horizontally and to have the capacity to engage and to plug into other bushes or other desiring machines, to use another Deleuze Guattarian kind of expression. And by doing that, having that intentionality about it means that this whole process becomes an act of love. And that then we start to think about, well, okay, you know, to quote again, this is one of the hits that I talk about all the time, but to quote that Massive Attack song, Teardrop, you know, love is a verb, love is a doing word. And bell hooks talks about this in All About Love, you know, that it's not just simply this thing that we are, but it's these constant micromolecular acts of love which make it happen. And by drawing a line of flight, which helps you to redraw yourself as a bush, encompassing all of those things that are explicit and implicit about what's going on in your relationship, you might find a better way of doing relating that works for everybody. That might result in you not being in a relationship with a person who might move away, or it might result in you being in a different kind of relationship. I mean, this whole thing also, you know, we could talk about endings here, but, you know, that's a whole kind of other thing, you know. That's a whole other podcast, I think, for me to talk about endings and all this stuff. But, yeah. So I hope you found that a bit helpful. I know it's a bit kind of, like with all of my stuff lately, it's a bit off-piece, but hopefully, like, interesting. And I hope that you feel, like, resourced by that rather than just discoursed. You know, if you can see, you know, if you can start to see some possibilities of opening up different ways of doing something, and to look at the resources that you already have, both you yourself, but also within your system, within your rhizome, then I think that you might all not only get over this particular thing that's making you feel guilty and that you don't feel like you can navigate at the moment, but actually I think it just has this, by really thinking in this more radical way about how you do relating, and picking up the pen and doing a line of flight, it won't just get over this bit, but it'll help you become, like, you know, like, super amazing. It'll help your relationship flourish in a way you didn't know was possible. And I think that's what becoming is. That's what becoming is. You're going to find out how you can flourish, because you don't know yet, but by doing it you will find out. Okay. Right, so that's it. Another just long chat. Part of the reason why it's taken me ages to do this is just that I've been spending so much time thinking about your question. So that's why I've done like a 52-53 minute answer. Sorry, not sorry. At least I'm not, you know, writing a 150 word column for The Guardian, or, you know, telling people what to think in a quick, you know, 7 minute rant, where I end up laughing at you and taking the piss out of you. Hopefully you like these kind of longer, more considered, as theoretical and also some often practical kind of responses. Anyway, so if you like the stuff and you want to support the show, tell your friends. Tell your friends to listen to it. So tell your rhizomes. Send it out to your rhizomes. You know, promoting shows that have the word sex in the title is an absolute nightmare. It's nigh on impossible, thanks to Foster Sester and the crackdown on sex workers in America, which has affected absolutely everybody, which is great. Thanks, Obama administration, for doing something absolutely awful for sex workers and anyone in the sex education field. Anyway, so spread this around your WhatsApp groups, send it to people, say, hey, this is an interesting podcast, you might like this, or, ooh, what about this, or, ooh, That's interesting. Send it to your folks and let's see if we can get more of increase our rhizome. I think of you all as being part of the rhizome. If you're not listening, if you don't press play on the show, it doesn't really exist, does it? You know. So by having these hundreds of listeners, many hundreds of listeners at times, then we are making the show happen, but also hopefully you're able to have these kind of interesting, considered conversations with each other too, and hopefully you'll find it beneficial. Last plug as well. I think I plugged the zines, megjohnandjustin.com/publications, where you can get the Make Your Own Relationship User Guide. But also, if you wanted to book a one-to-one coaching session with me to have a solution-focused chat, where I ask you, what are your best hopes? What will it look like when you get there? And how far have you got already? Three very straightforward questions. It's fun. It's brief. And it's incredibly effective. Sometimes it can work after one session. I had one session with somebody who's having an issue, and they wrote back saying it basically absolutely transformed everything. Often it doesn't work that quickly. Sometimes it works after a few months or so. But if you fancy having a coaching session, there is a link in the link tree in the show notes. link.tree/culturesexrel. Or just send me an email, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com. Right, I'm going to stop talking. I hope you have a wonderful rest of day. Let me know if there's anything you want me to talk about, or if you let me know about your rhizomes. Let me know whether you've been able to draw a line of flight and create a rhizome, create like a nice bush, and how that looks and how that changes and what that's in relation to. Right, but until next time, I'm going to stop talking now. It's been lovely chatting with you, and I'll chat with you again soon. Okay, bye.